session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, council. Ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Please, the court, David Rudd of the firm of Moore and Rudd in Georgetown. I have with me an associate, Kashim Chowdhury, who has worked on this matter and is sitting at council table.
Before you start, where do we go with this suggestion of death? What are the implications for this appeal?
The implication, as I understand it, Your Honor, would be that any funds that would be due to Mr. Crisp would now inure to his estate.
Has the estate been substituted as a party? Have you filed anything, made any motions?
I filed the suggestion of death, Your Honor, which I understood was the necessary document to notify the court that Mr. Crisp had died and that they are now the substitute party.
Well, they don't get automatically substituted because you wrote us a letter, so you'll need to follow up on that with the requisite paperwork. You know, if the estate really is going to want to enter an appearance and be a party in interest, it doesn't happen automatically.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was under the impression that under Rule 31, when I filed the suggestion of death with the documentation attached, that substituted the party, but I will follow up with that. Thank you, Your Honor. The matter now before the court involves the interpretation of two sections of the revocable trust of Kip Kelso Crisp, who was the wife of Leland Crisp. Mrs. Crisp died on November 28th of 2001, leaving no issue. The supplemental trust agreement, which is dated May 30th of 2000, restates several prior versions of the trust. In particular, what we're asking the court to do is consider the two sections that deal, or the one section that deals with the marital trust, or the marital gift, and the section that deals with the payment of expenses by the estate, or in this case, the trust. The requisite language is found in Section 4 of the trust, which begins, notwithstanding anything previously contained in this agreement to the contrary, and how that clause bears on that preceding term of the trust regarding the marital gift. Section 2B8 of the trust provides for the marital gift. That's found on page A61 of the appendix, and I think it's important. The language says that the trustee is to, quote, set aside an amount equal to one-third of the elective share as defined in 12 Delaware Code Section 902. And that set-aside is the marital gift.
When a marital share or elective share is involved, and doesn't that generally convey an intent to leave the minimum so that there's not the election? I mean, does that show an intent to give more than somebody would be entitled to under a statute?
My understanding on the elective share, Your Honor, is that typically it arises when either the document itself provides that is what the surviving spouse is to receive, or the document is silent as to any bequeath to the surviving spouse. And at that point, then the surviving spouse can file for the elective share under the statute. And the elective share is typically a one-third interest in the estate. That's the maximum that can be gifted pursuant to the elective share.
The elective shares generally are intended to avoid disinheritance.
Yes, that's correct.
So it basically sort of sets a minimum that the surviving spouse is to get as a general principle.
Yes, I would agree with that. And the way that works in this particular case, under the elective share statute, you have to determine the gross estate for federal estate tax purposes, and from that then deduct the funeral expenses, administrative expenses, debts of the estate, and claims against the estate. In this instance, we have no claims or debts of the estate. So we're focusing on the administrative expenses and the funeral expenses. That then leaves the net estate divided by three, which is the elective share. Thus, under the statute itself, the surviving spouse is obligated to pay one-third of all of the funeral expenses and administrative expenses. And in this particular case, that one-third amount was deducted, and the amount as calculated by the appellee was set aside. The balance of what was in the estate or in the trust was then designated as the residual trust, including the one-third of the expenses that were deducted from the marital gift. The total expenses in this particular case were $551,752. A one-third of that amount, which was deducted, was $183,917. So we're talking about a significant amount of expense. However, it's from reading of the trust, it was Mrs. Crist's intent, as stated in Section 4 of the trust, that Mr. Crist, or the marital gift, would not have to pay any of the estate expenses. As we all know, the seminal rule is that the trustor's intent controls in situations like this. It's not how the trustee may choose to interpret it, but it's what the trustee, the trustor, stated in the document.
Well, as you know, your opponent's argument is that there's a distinction between computing the amount he would inherit, which was net of taxes, and then actually paying the taxes, and that for purposes of the inheritance, we do a computation that included deductions for taxes, but when it came to actually paying the taxes, he wasn't paying any, it was all being paid by the residue.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor. And that particular, that focuses directly on the crux of the issue. Is there a conflict in the language of the, how the marital gift may be calculated versus how the taxes or the expenses and so forth are paid and the source of that payment? And we're saying that by the nature of the calculation, the statute and how it was actually applied deducted $183,000 from the marital gift, which it should not have done. That $183,000 then went into the residual trust. And to meet the intent of Mrs. Crist, that $183,000 should go back to the marital gift portion.
But as I understand your opponent's argument, it is that the inheritance was designated as a defined term. And then when you go to the definition, you find that it's net of taxes, and that the, you know, test matrix in this case knew that. And by picking a definition that was net of taxes, it would be contrary to her intent to add the taxes back in.
Well, the taxes are not part of the deduction. The taxes were paid by the residual trust. That's not an issue. It's the funeral bills and the administrative expenses, attorney's fees, executor's fees, cost, and so forth. And we're saying that under the language of Section 4 of the trust, the marital gift was not to have paid any of those expenses. And by deducting those expenses from the marital, the amount that was the marital gift, they were in violation of the intent of the trust. And that's where the notwithstanding language comes into play. The notwithstanding language saying, in spite of what may have been previously stated, it trumps and I've cited various cases where courts around the country have utilized that language of notwithstanding, in spite of, trumps, supersedes that prior language. So by applying the deduction in the marital gift, which had the notwithstanding language not been there, would have been proper. But because of the notwithstanding language, that money should be added back in.
And what do you want added back in specifically? What categories? Everything except the taxes, or the taxes also?
It would be the administrative expenses and the funeral bills.
And the attorney's fees.
Right. Well, the administrative expenses would include the attorney's fees, executor's fees, and costs. I think it's been agreed that the amount of the administrative expenses are $551,752, and that the one-third that we are discussing is $183,917. So that is the amount that is in issue here. The notwithstanding language in Section 4 of the trust states that notwithstanding anything, and I emphasize the word anything, previously contained in this agreement to the contrary, the trustee is directed to pay over from the portion of the residual trust that does not qualify for the marital deduction such funds necessary or desirable to pay funeral expenses, debts, and the cost of administration. So that's what we're saying should go back. But the administrative expenses and the funeral expenses.
But isn't it unusual to put what you're contending is part of a calculation for the marital gifts down in the residuary clause as opposed to the earlier paragraph that addressed the calculation expressly?
It would be if the notwithstanding language wasn't there. But we're saying that by having put that language in, Mrs. Crist showed a clear intent that regardless of any statement previously in the trust itself, that she did not want her husband and the marital gift to bear any of the cost of administration, and specifically indicates what those costs would be, the funeral expenses, cost of administration, which are typically the attorney's fees and executor's fees and other costs.
You're saying that that modified the earlier definition?
Yes. Yes.
Now, without that language, what would have happened? The calculation would have been of the elected chair, the marital gift, and without that language, there would have been a further deduction?
No, because once that marital gift had been established, then all of the expenses would have still been paid from the residual trust. But the effect was that the marital gift made a contribution toward those expenses of a one-third by having that deduction made, that calculation made. And we're saying that that was an improper deduction. It should have been ignored in the very first instance, but it was not, and went into the residual trust. Clearly, Mrs. Crist did not intend for her husband to pay for those, but as it's indicated, because of the formula that was used, that's what happened. And it's our position that to fulfill her intent, the marital gift should be reimbursed by this one-third amount. If not, Mr. Crist would bear that one-third cost contrary to Mrs. Crist's express directive. The appellee and the residual beneficiaries who have not joined in this appeal for whatever reason argued below that there was no conflicting language in the trust or how it was applied. The Court of Chancery accepted that and specifically found that for the notwithstanding clause to apply, there had to be a conflict in the language between the notwithstanding directive and the prior language in the trust. In the questions and answers, or in the questioning after the oral argument, we spoke to that, and in fact, the court asked and cited a position by Mr. Delapaz, who had represented the residual beneficiaries, and he said, isn't it appropriate to make this payment so that the marital gift did not twice bear those administrative expenses? That, to me, is a recognition that the marital gift had already paid or had to pay one-third of the expenses, and that the conflict then arises between that payment and what and how it has actually been applied. So the crux of the appeal rests on whether there is a conflict in this language between Section 2B8 and Section 4 of the trust. Your Honor, I have reserved some time for rebuttal. I see my time is
Up to you. You can stop now and save it or finish your...
Let me go ahead for just another moment or so. It's clear then in our position that this conflict exists. We ask the court to look at that language and how it's actually applied. In calculating the marital gift, the appellee should not have made that deduction. I also cited some cases and made an argument regarding the expense shifting, which is permitted under 12 Delaware Code Section 907. That permits a deceased spouse to have made a provision in a will or a trust for the benefit of the surviving spouse that they would not have to pay expenses and that would not affect their elective share rights. That had never been interpreted in Delaware that I could find, but similar provisions in other states have been interpreted. In Pennsylvania, there was a provision in the estate of Neiman that taxes were not to be paid from the elective share but borne by the residual estate, and the court found that the elective share did not have to make that payment. Similarly, in the state of Tennessee, there was a clause in a will, which was in the case cited as Commerce Union Bank versus Albert, that says that all taxes were to be paid from the residual estate, and it relieved the elective share from having to make those payments. The case in New York, estate of Robert Clark, was a large estate with assets both in New York and Virginia.
In these cases, was it argued, to your knowledge, that there was no conflict and that the notwithstanding didn't apply?
I'm sorry. This was a bit of a different... The notwithstanding did not come into that particular case. It was how you applied the calculation on the elective share using other language, which had specifically said that the money was to be paid from the residual. And in this case that we have, it says that the money is to be paid from the residual estate. So the notwithstanding language was not a part of these cases I'm citing, Your Honor. It's just showing that the intent of the testator in those other cases that I have cited was that the residual share was to pay, and the courts relieved the elective share of the obligation of having to contribute to expenses. And as I indicated, the case of Robert Clark, or the estate of Robert Clark, which was a New York case, found that based on the provisions in the will, the entire tax burden and administrative expenses were not payable by a spouse.
Mr. Rudd, I found it interesting in looking at the briefs that as each party tries to sort through the mechanism for paying these expenses, you use the phrases repeatedly that the estate's expenses are to be borne by the residuary trust or paid by the residuary trust, and the other side refers to the expenses as coming from the residuary trust or solely out of the residuary trust. Is there any significance to those particular choices of words?
We are. I've used the language from the trust language itself, Section 4 of the trust, which is found on Appendix A69, and it says the trustee is directed to pay over. So as far as the semantics, I feel that the trust is straightforward, that the trustee is to pay out of or pay over from the residual trust. I don't know if there's any significance other than parsing of words, perhaps between counsel and I, but we still feel that the trust, the residual trust, should bear all the expenses, and that to fulfill the intent of Mrs. Chris, there should be a reimbursement.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I'm Don Sparks, Richards, Latham & Finger, here on behalf of the Appellee PNC Bank, Delaware. We're here before the Court today on a matter of trust construction that involves a single issue, whether the language in the decedent's trust governing the calculation of the marital gift to be paid to her husband is in conflict with the language in the trust governing the payment of the estate's expenses. The Court below properly concluded that there is no conflict between the two provisions, and that Mr. Crisp's claim to be reimbursed for an expense that the marital gift never paid must fail. For the reasons that follow, this Court should affirm the judgment of the Court below. First, as Mr. Crisp's counsel conceded in the Court below, PNC's calculation conforms with the requirements of Section 2B8 of the Trust and is the same as the computation of the spouse's elective share under the Delaware Elective Share Statute. The language in Section 2B8 is quite specific and clearly reflects the decedent's intent to provide Mr. Crisp with a distribution from the trust that mirrors the amount that he would have received from the trust under the Delaware Elective Share Statute's computations. There's no suggestion in Section 2B8 or anywhere else in the trust that he's entitled to anything more.
But isn't there a suggestion that the trustor did not want him to pay for these?
And in fact, Your Honor, the trustor, that is true, and Mr. Crisp and the marital gift did not pay for those expenses. The expenses were paid for solely out of the residuary trust.
But the calculation assumes that he will pay at least part of it, right?
No. The calculation takes into account the requirements of the Delaware Elective Share Statute, which require that there be a deduction for certain expenses, funeral expenses, administrative expenses, et cetera, deductible under sections 2053 and 2054 of the code. It's a matter of definition or computation. It is not a question of what fund bears the payment.
How is that different than having an estate pay an inheritance tax, which is a matter of, or was, a matter of calculation? If the testator's intent is that the beneficiary of the marital gift doesn't pay any expenses, if the computation implicitly allows for calculation of expenses, why isn't there an amount added back to cover it?
The answer to that, Your Honor, has to do with the definition in Section 902 of Title 12 of the elective estate, and it also has to do with the fact that the computation is designed to refer to federal estate tax concepts that take into the account these expenses, but also provide a separate source of funds from which those expenses are to be paid. For example, there are many instances where there are marital deduction formula clauses used in planning for the federal estate tax, where various deductions and credits are taken into account in calculating the amount of the marital deduction, even though the actual payment of the expenses or taxes generating the deduction or credit is made by funds that do not qualify for the marital deduction. And again, that is exactly what has happened here.
Well, is there a distinction in your mind between the phraseology that Mr. Rutt's been using about the residuary is bears the expense or they shall be borne by, and your position that it's simply the mechanism through which it's paid?
I don't believe there's any distinction in the phraseology. The fact is that the residuary trust paid for all of the expenses, the entire $552,000 of administrative expenses.
They paid all the expenses. Did that residuary estate bear all of the expenses?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. I don't believe there's any distinction with respect to that. Again, the formula is quite specific. It defines the marital gift as an amount that is equal to one-third of the elective estate, which is defined in Section 902 of Title 12, and then it requires that there be subtracted from that amount the amount of all transfers made to Mr. Crisp determined in accordance with Section 903 of Title 12 of the Delaware Code.
So none of that's in dispute up to that point.
None of that's in dispute. And so the first step in determining the marital gift is you go to the calculation of the value of the elective estate. Once the value of the elective estate is determined and multiplied by one-third, then the next step is to determine all the other transfers made to Mr. Crisp in accordance with Section 903 of Title 12, subtract that amount from one-third of the elective estate. That is the amount of the marital gift, and that is literally what Section 2B8 says. Now, The interplay between the elective share statute and the federal estate tax law is significant because the Delaware elective share statute, unlike the elective share statute in many other states, is specifically tied to federal estate tax concepts. And it requires, it defines the elective estate as the amount of the decedent's gross estate for federal estate tax purposes minus those deductions allowed under sections 2053 and 2054 of the Internal Revenue Code. It is those deductions that are at issue here. And then there are various other adjustments that are made to the federal gross estate to arrive at the elective estate for purposes of the Delaware elective share statute. In this particular case, Mrs. Crisp's gross estate was $26,490,078. And then there was added back to that an amount equal to half of the jointly held property that was excluded from the estate tax return, and it was, and then the aggregate amount of the funeral and administrative expenses, again approximately $552,000, were subtracted from the gross estate. That yielded an elective estate under the Delaware elective share statute of $26,672,640, and one-third of that is $8,890,880. And then from that is backed out the various other things that Mr. Crisp received, and that resulted in the amount of the marital gift that's set forth in the calculation that PNC did. The important point is that the calculation carefully follows the requirements of the statute, and because the statute specifically incorporates federal estate tax concepts, including that deduction for funeral expenses and administration expenses, the calculation takes those expenses into account in arriving at the marital gift. And as I said, that's absolutely consistent with the requirements of the Delaware statute. It's also consistent and typical with respect to marital deduction formula clauses used in planning for the federal estate tax, where, again, you have various deductions and credits taken into account in calculating the amount of the marital deduction, even though the actual payment of the expenses or taxes that generate the deduction or credit are made from funds that do not qualify for the marital deduction.
All right, so it's, there's no issue about the marital elective share or the marital gift being properly calculated in accordance with the law.
There is none.
And we all understand that. The issue, at least as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this is not my primary area of the law, did the testatrix know at the time she signed that the language that she used or elected to use in the total document itself would encompass that definition in such a way that defining her marital gift's share would necessarily reduce it by definition by certain expenses?
And I believe the answer to that question is yes, Your Honor, that she did. And again, contrary to what the appellant is arguing here, taking expenses into account when calculating or providing a definition for the marital gift is different from actually paying those expenses from the marital gift.
What is the purpose of the notwithstanding language? If you look at that paragraph, why doesn't it just start with the word trustee? What does the notwithstanding, et cetera, mean?
The notwithstanding clause refers to nothing specific here, but in general, that notwithstanding clause is designed to prevent the payment of any taxes or expenses from any other trust other than the residuary trust created under the terms of the trust agreement. For example, in this particular trust, there were perpetual charitable trusts that were created in other provisions of the trust agreement. Or if a marital trust were created, the marital trust. And the idea of that notwithstanding clause is to make it clear that the source of funds for the payment of the funeral expenses, debts, administration expenses, and taxes is the residuary trust. And in that way, to preserve the charitable deductions or the marital deductions against the federal estate tax that would be available for those trusts by ensuring that the trusts were not reduced by the payment of taxes or expenses.
And the simple distinction would be that these other trusts, whether charitable or otherwise, marital, charitable, trusts for other individuals, in defining them, one doesn't do the kind of definition, or doesn't apply the same kind of definition that includes expenses as one does for the marital elective share. Is that correct?
Well, again, Your Honor, it's typically the case in marital deduction formula clauses used in planning for the federal estate tax that you would actually have a similar computation with respect to the calculation of either the marital gift or the marital deduction. That is to say, there would be a reference in the marital deduction formula clause the various deductions or credits against the federal estate tax that would be taken to account in calculating the amount of the marital gift.
So in the definition of a marital trust, you might run into the very same thing.
Exactly so. Exactly so. And again, I don't want to get too far afield, but for example, there are references in marital deduction formula clauses to credits against state death taxes, credits for previously taxed property, deductions available against the federal estate tax that are all taken into account in defining or calculating the amount of the marital gift. That same concept has equal application here. Again, the funds from which the taxes or expenses are actually paid is still the residuary trust or the residuary estate. But the definition itself refers to the calculation of those deductions or credits. In any event, I think we've belabored the point that taking expenses into account when calculating or defining the marital gift is different from actually paying those expenses from the marital gift. I would prefer to spend the remaining amount of time on this argument that's based on the notwithstanding clause, because that seems to me to be the crux of the matter. The argument is that the notwithstanding clause contained in Section 4 of the trust, which is the payment of taxes and expenses section of the trust, was meant to deal with an alleged conflict between the provisions in Section 2B8, the definition of the marital gift, and the provisions in Section 4 governing the payment of the taxes and expenses. But the claim based on the notwithstanding clause is dependent on a conflict that does not in fact exist. Again, one provision here governs the definition or computation of the marital gift. The other deals with the actual payment of the funeral expenses, administration expenses, debts, and taxes. It's perfectly consistent with the decedent's intent to give effect to both clauses. Nowhere in Section 2B8 does the language specify that any expenses are to be paid from the marital gift, and in fact, no expenses were paid from the marital gift. The burden of paying the expenses fell on the residuary. Nowhere in Section 4 does the language refer to the computation of the marital gift. And in fact, PNC made no adjustments in the computation because of any language in Section 4. In the absence of any conflict, the argument that the notwithstanding clause was somehow meant to trump or modify the specific calculation in Section 2B8 should fail. Even if there were an apparent inconsistency, the rules of trust construction require this court to endeavor to reconcile the two apparently inconsistent provisions rather than to ignore either. But no such endeavor is required here. There's no ambiguity in the language in the trust concerning the calculation of the marital gift or the payment of the taxes. PNC correctly calculated the marital gift in accordance with the plain language of Section 2B8. It correctly paid the expenses solely out of the residuary trust. Common sense, the settlor's intent, the Delaware elective share statute, the federal tax law, and if necessary, the rules of trust construction, all lead to the conclusion that the appellant's contention is an error and that the decision of the Court of Chancery should be affirmed.
Well, hypothetically, if there was a conflict that required reconciliation, how would you suggest that be done?
Well, if there was a conflict that required, then the specific should overrule the general, and the specific computation is set forth in Section 2B8. The conflict is dependent on an assumption that calculating or defining is the same as paying, and it is not.
Well, it's arguably the same as bearing the expense if it reduces the amount.
Well,
at the end of the definition.
My suggestion would be to think about it differently, Your Honor, and that is that if the focus is on the notwithstanding clause, which it appears to be, and the argument is that somehow the notwithstanding clause requires, there's no debate about the correctness of the calculation. The argument really is that the notwithstanding clause requires PNC to credit the marital gift with one-third of the estate expenses. In other words, to add it back after the calculation has been done. But I submit that the notwithstanding clause doesn't suggest anything like that. And I explained earlier in response to Justice Holland's question what the notwithstanding clause is there for. The calculation in Section 2B8 does not shift one-third of the estate expenses to Mr. Crist, and no expenses were in fact paid from the marital gift. Again, for that reason, Mr. Rutt's reliance on the language in Section 907A, which wasn't argued in the court below, has no application here.
In support of your position, if we look at the plain language after the notwithstanding, what it says is that the residuary trust is supposed to pay the money over to the executor or the administrator. And that's what the language talks about doing. if in fact it was to go further and recalculate or credit back something to the marital share, you would expect to find different language, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would.
But if we literally read this paragraph, what we're seeing is that the residuary trust is supposed to take the money for the taxes and costs and give them to the executor.
Yes. And I should mention that in connection with that, that if the interpretation of PNC is not correct, then what would happen would be that, well, we've received a federal estate tax closing letter in this estate quite some time ago, which is an indication on the part of the Internal Revenue Service that they've accepted the federal estate tax return and the marital deductions claimed in the federal estate tax return as filed. If a contrary conclusion is reached, then of course it would be PNC's obligation to go back, amend the federal estate tax return, and file a claim for refund, because there would be an additional marital deduction that would be generated as a result of this add-back of $183,000 or $184,000 to the marital gift. And that clearly was not the decedent's intent. Thank you.
Mr. Rutt, you have an additional 36 seconds.
I may not take the long run.
Mr. Sparks spoke in terms of other estates and marital deductions and so forth. However, we need to focus on this estate, this document, and what it says. He was also asked whether Mrs. Chris knew at the time she signed if it would encompass the elective share deductions. There's no evidence to suggest that that is the case. There's no parole evidence allowed in this particular instance.
Well, Mr. Rutt, how do you answer my question? If I read the language of this paragraph, it says the residuary trust is supposed to give the money to the executor. And then what you're arguing to us is that somehow money should also be given back, you know, to the marital share. Where do we find that language in this paragraph?
The language that needs to be focused on is where it says, notwithstanding anything previously contained to the contrary. And to that extent, where there was a calculation made and money was deducted from the marital gift, then what that section is saying is that the residual trust has to bear all the expenses. And frankly, the deduction should have not been made in the first instance, or credit should have been given, so that the marital gift would not have borne any of the expenses. The trustee has to pay the money to the executor, who has the obligation of making that payment. But that, I think, is that, Your Honor, is the section that needs to be focused on, notwithstanding anything contained to the contract. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and we're adjourned.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.